I'm so spoiled. He's going to come out and move the mics. Isn't that great? Thank you. Terry! Thank you.
Aren't I fabulous?
You are the best. My name is Janice Del Campo, and I'm an alcoholic. Whew, gives you chills, doesn't it? My sobriety date is May 3rd, 1981. And my home group is the Happy Way Group in Denver, Colorado. We're at 3159 South Broadway. We have 10 meetings a week. And when you're in town, I hope that you'll come see us. We meet every night at 7 o'clock, and we have a few extras on weekends, so we'd love to have you there. My goodness, there are a lot of people in this room. And I asked them to move the mics because I couldn't see, and then I could see, and I'm like, well, let's move the mics back up. This is the most... I don't do that cry thing from up here, okay? We have things to talk about, and it isn't about my crying. But this roundup is one of the most phenomenal experiences I've had in my entire life, to be together with so many wonderful people with so many open hearts. You can feel it. I got up here, and I believe the reason I started to cry was the power of the Creator in this room is so powerful. It is overwhelming. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, the Oz man for staying in touch. He sent me the program at one point, and I wrote him back. I didn't know he'd send it, and I said, could you like send me a program? And it was on my computer. But everybody's been great. Sweet Don, who picked us up, and of course, my love, Tim, with whom I share spirit. There's just so many people to name that we maybe God will help me tell some stories that include all that. But Shannon, thank you so much for giving into the water deal. I really needed it. My friends Harlan and Zan, the list is endless. Man, I'm not at the Academy Awards, so buck up. We're moving on. I just can't do it. And I heard most of the speakers. I did not hear Carl yesterday, and so I went up to Carl. I said, I'm really sorry. It was great, right? I went up to Carl. I said, I'm so sorry. I was in bed. And he said, it's okay, because you see, I'm leaving before you get up tomorrow. I'm not listening to you either. Carl and I have met on the road. I'll tell you what we're doing right now. We're just kind of goofing off. And the reason is that I was always shown that when you get up to give a talk, the power of the Creator is going to come through and speak to whoever it is I need to speak to. I don't know who that is. And so I kind of wait for that energy to kick in, and if it doesn't kick in, it's going to be a really short meeting. So we're just going to visit a little while and see what the big guy has to say. Yes! Yes! You know, it's a terrible fear being up here and every speaker gets a balloon, and I'm thinking, you know, God, it'd be really nice if you pop one for me. Do we have any Al-Anons in the audience? Get them up. How come they're all, most of them are over here? Is there something about the table set up? Anyway, I want you all to know something. I love Al-Anons, and I hope you come to love them as much as I do. And I have a couple of soapbox issues, maybe 10, but this is the first one. We don't understand a lot, and I hear really a lot of nasty jokes in AA meetings. You know, we make deriding comments, derisive comments about them. And I need to tell you something, that is not okay. Yes. You might want to pop into one of their meetings sometime and listen to the pain and suffering that was caused as a result of our alcoholism and the disease that they live with as a result of that. And not only that, but their own pain that they bring to their program, and we have much to learn from them. So I just, you know, and if you haven't been to a meeting, then you don't know, and we're not supposed to talk about stuff we don't know anything about. All right. So, based on that, I'm going to tell an Al-Anon joke. Do you know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? None. They detach and let it screw itself. And I like to say, for any alcoholic that didn't understand that joke, grab an Al-Anon, they're going to tell you all about it. Do you want one more? I got an alcoholic joke. Do you know what the difference is between an alcoholic and a dog? Shh. The dog quits whining when you let him indoors. Okay, I quit. I'd like to see a show of hands of those people with 1 year or less. I want to see them. 1 year or less. Get them on up there. I hope I'm talking to one of you. See, I don't know who you are out there that I'm going to visit with, but there's somebody out there that I'm going to visit with. And I don't know who you are. I can look at this sea of faces. If one person connects with my alcoholism and the solution and being recovered, I've done my job here. So I want to talk about that. And also to Al-Anons, I want you to know that if you don't have our disease, you really don't know what we're talking about. People who do not have, we have a disease that the craving never occurs in the average temperate drinker. The thing that we as alcoholics suffer with, other people just don't have. And so when we've got someone in our lives, they just don't get it. You know, and not because they don't want to get it, it's a little confusing. So I'm hoping that you will hear something about alcoholism that will help you in your journey. Because we're weird. We're just weird, you know, the way we behave. I mean, how many times did we hear, oh, honey, why do you behave like that? Oh, dear, can't you just have one glass of wine? I just don't understand why this goes on. You know, we went to a party, you were fine. Next thing I know, you have the lampshade on your head. I mean, what's the deal? That's what this is about. And to the 1 year, there is a solution. I want you to know that what I was told by my sponsor is, I can't remember, I was told so many things. I was told a couple of things right in the beginning. Whew, I'm there now. Okay. You never have to drink again, and you never have to feel the way you're feeling right now, ever again. I'm going to tell you that's a promise, because I've experienced it. I want to also tell you I have absolutely no idea where God's going to go with this talk, because I'm in the middle of a huge spiritual change once again. I'm going to talk a lot about my teacher. I was with my teacher for 20 years. And so it was great to hear Bob talk last night about how long he has been with his teacher, because I have come from the school of accountability. And accountability, to me, isn't going to a different sponsor every year to share a different part of my life so that nobody ever really gets to know me completely. When I speak of my teacher, and I call him my teacher today, when we first started, he was my sponsor. And I did have a man sponsor. Don't panic. I wasn't looking for a date. And if you'd met this guy, you'd understand. But when they say, I mean, he was cute, but, you know, he wasn't that cute. So, in that process, I'm always cracking jokes. Anyway, I can't remember, so I must be needing to tell you something else. I'm a little nervous up here. My friend, and I don't want to make a big deal out of it, but my friend had to move on last year. He just sort of transitioned right out of the earth plane, and it's been just about a year, and occasionally, being here in this room, I want to tell you there's a large number of people here who come from my circle and family of recovery. So it's been a little hard emotionally to be here, but I will talk about him a lot because he showed the way. He did not show the way by telling me what to do. He showed the way by living it and by helping me, by sweeping away prejudice a bit, he allowed me my own journey with the spirit of the universe. And that's what our job is here, is not to give somebody else our God, not to tell them how to do it, but to awaken the doors and to be patient and to show the way. And that's what I was given. Let me talk a little bit about my alcoholism. I hear people get up here and say, you know, I don't need to talk about my alcoholism. Everybody knows I'm a drunk. Well, you want to know something? That's not the truth. I don't know you're a drunk. you know, is if we don't make that connection right up front, it isn't happening. If you and I don't sit down with each other and have that connection that only alcoholics can have, we got no place to go. I'm not saying we need to talk about our alcoholism for an hour and a half up here, but I want to know if that person I'm talking to out there hears me. So I want you to come on a journey with me. Look at you all looking at me. She's up there looking, smiling, you know. It's like, God, don't be looking. knock that off. Anyway, come on a journey with me, and I don't know when this happened to you. It may have been your first drink. It may have been the second time you're out. It may have been the 10th. Our friend Jerry said he didn't even hit it until he was 27, so you didn't have to do it when you were 15. Please look for similarities and not for differences. Our backgrounds may be different. Our upbringing may be completely different. Our educational levels will be different. But the thing that is our common bond is what happens to us when we put alcohol in our body. The book tells us it's mental and physical. And without the physical component, we have absolutely no place to start. And it was through the guidance of my teacher that I got that. And you want to know how many years of sobriety I had before I got it? 5. Okay, so if you don't think you have it, I don't care how many years you got, if you're confused, we must find out. Because it helps us find out if we belong here or not. I remember my first real drink. The others were not real. that's a weird statement. Actually, my first few drinks, I was raised in a family where we did a lot of entertaining. I found out later that our family entertained most of the city. But we used to like to have people over, you know, for dinner and such, and there was a lot of drinking, and it was just what you did. So anyway, I was out at a party. My sister had gotten married, and we were having the big dinner and doing that sort of stuff. And I'm sitting at a table with my brother and his girlfriend, and I can see it as clearly today as if it were happening right in front of my eyes. And we were sitting at one of those tables, you know, like a cocktail table, prior to go into dinner. You know, the kind with the white linen tablecloth. It's a little round. It's got those, you know, little like wrought iron heart-shaped little chairs with the wooden seats. See? And he says, I'm going to go get us all a drink. So I thought, okay. And he came back, and he was holding this glass out to me. And it was sort of a murky-looking glass. They call them highball glasses, and I've been thinking a lot about that name, highball glasses. It's weird. But, you know, don't you think that's a weird thing? I don't know where they got it. So he's bringing me this glass, and I saw it, and he handed it to me. I'm going to be an adult. And he gave me my drink. It was a Tom Collins. You know, they're kind of murky looking. And I took that drink, and I drank it on down, and the most unusual thing happened. It hit about here, and I was able to take a breath. I didn't know I couldn't breathe before that. You know, it's like my bronchioles opened. I was like, man, and they got warm. It was, you know, it was nice. So I drank that drink, and you know what I did next? I did what every good up-and-coming alcoholic does. What was that? I love a room that's full of alcoholics. I'll check in with you every once in a while. Absolutely, I ordered another drink. You know, and I loved it. I loved who I became. I loved how I felt. I just loved everything about it. I got a little taller. I got big boobs. I got funnier. I was totally at ease. Life was good. I was already funny, so I thought I'd say funnier. But I was at complete ease, you know, with that first drink. And it began a pattern that was going to last for another 15 years, including the fact that I tried to pick up the Irish priest at the time of the dinner. Now, and it really wasn't, I mean, I didn't know anything about taking him back to my bedroom or anything. I just wanted to flirt. And so I was singing him Irish love songs. The guy was actually an Irish priest from Ireland, a Catholic priest. And he was so cute, you know, the ruddy cheeks. And I'm like, this man's for me. Well, that was to begin a long journey of the men that were for me. So, oh, this was the spiritual speaker. Isn't that how you peg this? I need to tell you something. Nothing we do is separate from spiritual. Nothing is separate from spirit. This is no more spiritual speaker than Friday night, Tuesday morning, at the coffee shop, at work. Nothing is separate. And I love to talk to you about the fact that when I am billed as a spiritual speaker, I like to talk about toilets. And And the reason is, ladies, have you used this bathroom over here? Is that wild? Everything is automated. Toilets, soap, water. I mean, you don't have to do anything, you know? It's like stick your hand out there. It's great. It was great. I have no idea where these come from sometime. My dear and wonderful traveling companion, Tom, is out here. My love, my sweetie. My friends at home call him my road manager. But anytime that stuff comes out, I look at Tom and go, I don't know where that came from. So anyway, that first drink began a long, long journey of alcohol. I can't make a long story short, but I'm going to make it short. But that journey lasted for 15 years. I came in at 15 and I got sober at 30. And that time in between, okay. The way I like to encapsulate it is to say I stayed too long at the fair. The lights went out and I couldn't find my way home. Everybody had left and I didn't know where I was. I love drinking, I love everything that came with it, but I was never a woman who I can remember had one drink. You know, when I'm sponsoring people and you'll be talking with them about the phenomenon of craving and how that showed up in their lives, and then they start telling me about the times that they knew that they only had a drink or two and went home. I'm like, really? How many times did you do that? They're saying, I think I did it 5 times. I'm like, really? How long did you drink? 20 years. Couple things about that. If you're still focusing on the times that you were able to go home after a drink, there's a pretty good chance you're not done. I'm not kidding you. Because if you can remember that, then that's the excuse for not stopping. That's the excuse for not surrendering, because you're still thinking you got some power. And I was fortunate enough when I came in here at 30 years old, I had no power. I was done, I was toasted, I was exhausted, I was tired of living that way, I was tired of behaving in a manner that I was not raised to behave. I was tired of the hangovers, I was tired of ending up in sleazy bars. I'm a doctor's kid, man. And you know, we have like this persona that we do. And I ended up in, and you know what, I thought I was okay in those bars. You wanna know why? Because I pressed my t-shirts and my jeans and I wore Shalimar perfume, which cost me more probably than my rent. But I was convinced I was better than people in that room. So anyway, I was raised in Southwest Texas. I want you to know that, on the border with Juarez. At the time that I was drinking, ooh, okay, probably saw you there. Anybody who plods being in that vicinity was drunk. Otherwise, okay, believe me. I went into a bar once, I drank in there to find my glasses during the daytime. Oh my God, it was terrifying. So I waited till after dark from there on. But so we would drink at these bars in Juarez. You could drink for 35 cents a mixed drink. So a $5 bill went a long time. Yeah, I'm pretty old. And so So I loved to go over there. I loved to drink. I loved everything that came with it. And I'm going to tell you right now, I had a really good time early on in my drinking. I was a party girl who loved to go out. I always had good jobs. I don't have, you know, I never got arrested. I like, see, it doesn't come. Never got arrested and probably should have been. Never got thrown in jail. We didn't do DUIs then. You know, if you, it was a small town, they got you home, that kind of stuff. But I loved alcohol. I loved country western jukeboxes. I loved pool tables. I liked those boys with the pointy toe boots. My friend turned to me and said, oh my God, Bob has boots on with a suit last night. I'm like, yes. And but I loved to drink. It was fun. And I'm sure it was fun for some of you. So anyway, I keep drinking through my teens. I will tell you, I had a brother who died in a car wreck when he was about 11. I was 11, he was 15, he was killed in a car wreck. There were 6 kids. And it was a pretty tragic time for us. We looked like we had the perfect family. My mother had a drinking problem, and she was an alcoholic, but it really escalated at that time. After that happened, my family never, ever was able to touch each other ever again, if we even did before that. The pain and the grief was so intense that we all sort of went our separate ways rather than coming together. My mother's alcoholism increased. And the things that they would give us to numb or to help us overcome the emotional problems we had were drugs. My dad's best friend was a psychiatrist, and at that age, I was put on things like Stelazine, Elavil, and Dalmane. So I was a smooth-moving girl, and I could sleep at night. My mother was put on Seconals. So she would make that deadly combination of alcohol and Seconals. And you see, I love my mother with all my heart. We had the best time, and I never criticized what she did, because I believe even then my heart knew how tortured she was. And so just like we heard from another speaker, there were suicide attempts, there was all that stuff. The reason I'm telling you this is your background has nothing to do with your alcoholism. You see, the stuff that I went through, I came from a war zone. Some of you did and some of you didn't. But those of us who came from a war zone, that is not what makes us an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is when I put alcohol in my body, I want more alcohol, and when I don't want any alcohol, I do it anyway. We come from a culture today where I sit in meetings and people are saying things like, you know, I was sexually abused, that's why I'm an alcoholic. I need to tell you something. Plenty of people out there have been sexually abused, take a drink, and they don't like it. So we have to learn to separate that out. Also, I want to say this. There's a line in our book in the ninth step where it says, we feel a man is unthinking when he says being sober is enough. I believe not only in being sober here, but I believe in getting well. And if you want to get well, we can do that here. At the ripe old age of 18, I found my first amphetamine. Somebody was kind enough to give that to me because I came in really hungover, and he said to me, man, you look terrible. And I said, I'm just feeling horrible. He says, I'll give you something that'll help you feel better. Sounds good to me. Handed me a capsule, little green capsule, and I took it, and in about 20 minutes, I had a spiritual experience. It was the most remarkable thing. My eyes open, my head was clear, and that hangover was gone. I know none of you ever did that, but I loved it. And of course, we wouldn't call it speed. Diet pills. You know, preludins, things like that. Diet pills. And because you're a doctor's kid, you don't ever shoot up. Junkies shoot up, okay? I get pills. And so then became the awful cycle. The awful cycle of needing the speed to drink and drinking to come down from the speed and a little Valium to help you go to sleep. I will talk about drugs here. And the reason is because I came here through another fellowship believing that I was a drug addict. I am not a drug addict. I found out that I did drugs to enhance and improve my alcohol experience. And I'm not saying people are or aren't. I mean, I'm not going to get into the debate, but where I'm fortunate is I had a sponsor who happened to be an alcoholic, properly armed with facts about himself, who had done a lot of drugs that helped me find my way. And because of that, I found out what I was powerless over. If I don't know what I'm powerless over, I don't need a power greater than myself to solve the problem. It's very simple. And also, I was taught that you cannot have a spiritual experience if you're living a lie. And, you know, I do a little bandstanding. You know, I'm going to say something really quick here. People listen to tapes, and they think that the people that are giving the talks are speaking for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how AA feels. I want to clarify that right now. All I've got is my experience, strength, and hope, not only for the things I've done, but for the people I've worked with. I hear people today say a drug is a drug is a drug. I'm going to tell you right now, it's a lie. And you know what? Come see me afterwards. If you want to discuss, I have no problem with that. I'm not worried about people not liking me. I am here because somebody in this room is dying because they don't know what they are. Was it you? Okay? And I know I come across with stuff, and you know what? I've been given the great gift through great teachers that if everybody likes you, you're probably doing something wrong. And it's been a tough, it is. It's not an easy role, but the Creator, I'm here to share that. You know, there are times I get really tired of traveling, and I'm not even a hot dog. I go once a month. And I do workshops, that kind of stuff, but it isn't always easy to do this. And I remember I went to my sponsor once and I said, I'm sick of this. I am just sick of it. I'm not going to do this anymore. And he said, you know what, honey? He says, I know you don't want to do it. He said, you don't want to do it anymore? He said, but please don't say you won't. This is the same person who, when I said to him after a friend of mine had overdosed, What happened? What was wrong? Why did he do this? He'd worked the steps. He said, who was he working with? That was the first question out of his mouth. His mouse. Anyway. Do you love this? Anyway, during that conversation, I said, well, how do you know if you're doing enough? And I was told, you can never do enough. Because the first time I start thinking I know what enough is, it's Tuesday mornings, it's Wednesday afternoons, and it's Saturday. What am I going to do? I'm barely going to do enough. It says half measures avail us nothing. Not a quarter, not an eighth, nothing. All right? And I have to listen to that sentence, and every time I hear it, I go, am I doing a half measure? So anyway, I turned into the wonderful world of speed. It helps you shoot pool better. People would bet on me. I'd just see the shot. It was great. Country Western music, cowboys. I mean, I just loved the whole scene, everything that came with it. And I have friends today that when I'm doing something at a meeting, they'll all show up in their boots. Or after a talk, they'll come up and say, did you see these? And but I loved it. And that speed allowed me to keep drinking. You know, I'd wake up with a hangover, I'd take a little speed, could get to work. I became a great employee when I was doing speed. I did great things very quickly. And then the next morning, I couldn't remember what I did, but my desk was clean. So then I'd go to the bar. Girlfriend and I would say, well, let's go over there and have a couple of drinks. And I really believed I was going to do that. I believed we were going to go for happy hour and I was going to go home. I'm the one that said, honey, I'll be home at 7. Of course, I said that to the drug dealer. And I could not get home at 7 o'clock. Not only could I not get there, I didn't care if I got there. Once I started to drink, something happened and I was going to keep drinking. And I was baffled sometimes. Other times I just didn't care. The book describes the sort of mental thinking that goes on. You know, like we find all these reasons to do it, not do it, rainy day, sunny day, taking a trip, not taking a trip. And, you know, we come up with a million reasons. Most of the time, I didn't need any. It says sometimes I never think at all. That was me. It just, whatever had happened last night was gone. Waking up in that seedy motel room down on Colfax in Denver. Have you ever woken up in a motel room and looked out and said, where am I? And where are my shoes? That's how I lived. I will never do this again, I said in the morning. Did anybody ever say that? I will never do this again. My dear sweet Al-Anons, we meant it, honest to God, every time we said it. We did. You know, and we laughed, but I mean, I meant it. My intention was never to drink again. Who in their right mind would want to get up and go do that again? And the weirdest thing would happen. 5 o'clock, happy hour, something in my mind would change. That's the second aspect of alcoholism. When I put it in my body, I keep drinking. And when I am convinced I will never drink again, I do it. I cannot bring into my consciousness the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. Sometimes I can't bring it in my consciousness from 8 hours ago. It's as though it never happened. And I take a drink, and the next thing I know, the same stuff is happening, but I don't care. Now, if you can relate to that, that's alcoholism. This stuff about people talking about their past being the problem, I'm going to give you a little example. This has come to me because I was a girl who came from a war zone, okay? And if I figured it out that let's say I have a girlfriend and she lives next door to me, and we had the exact same upbringing. We had alcoholism, anger, violence, suicides, death. We had all that stuff in common. And we step out into the world at 15 years old. She takes a drink, doesn't like it. I take a drink, I'm drunk. It's very important here for me that I separate that out and that I get well. I'm huge on it, and the reason is I believe that I'm healing finally as a person. I've got almost 25 years. And maybe we can talk about this amend. It took me until I had 18 years of sobriety to find peace with my father, who had been dead almost 35 years. It can be done. Not that I did it. It's that I had a willing heart, and God did it. He worked through me. And also, I believe this. I was given the gift of forgiveness. I don't know why I'm talking about this, but I do not believe that forgiveness is an act of the will. It's a willing heart that allows the Creator through to open my heart to forgive. Here's another weird thing. You can't forgive others if you haven't forgiven yourself for certain things. And so anyway, we can talk about that later. It's a little out there. So I kept drinking, and it is. It's a little hoo-hoo. Say, God, we're not going to hoo-hoo today. I saved that for breakfast with friends. But it is fun to hoo-hoo because it tells us that we're going to be spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation. And I'd imagine spearheads get together and do that hoo-hoo. So anyway, I drank until I was 30 years old, the last drink. I can't remember my last drink. And also, if you're thinking your last drink is going to keep you sober, that's a lie. Remembering your last drink isn't going to do anything for you except you to help others when you sit at the kitchen table with them. Any remembrances of what happened to me is not enough. You know, triggers. I like triggers. This is interesting. I have a girlfriend that got loaded after 12 years. She went out on pain pills and Xanax. I have an issue about Xanax also because I've watched my friends get loaded. And it's been a really scary thing. But she went out and she's still out, by the way. She's trying to find her way back, and I forgot what I was going to tell you. What was I going to tell him, Tom? It's gone. All right. So God must be moving on to where I need to be. I get off telling these stories. So anyway, God love you. What would I do without you? I'm going to talk about triggers. So anyway, she comes back, and I'm not going to criticize treatment centers. That isn't it. We get sober where we get sober. The different places where we get sober help us find our way. And she came out telling me about triggers. And she said, you know, this is a trigger, that's a trigger. I can't do this because I might drink, and I can't do that because I might drink. And all of a sudden I thought, you know, and I said to her, I said, you know, my face in the morning is a trigger. Now that I'm 54 and I look in the mirror, that is a trigger. Here's the deal, and I'm not saying triggers aren't triggers, but life is a trigger. Life is a trigger. And if the idea of triggers helps, what a trigger does is it triggers the mind, and I have no protection in my mind against the next drink. But that doesn't mean I don't call somebody, that I don't get my butt to a meeting, that I don't call my sponsor, that I don't go and help somebody. When those little things go off, what I was taught to do is get to a meeting. Call somebody and tell them it's going off. But as long as I believe there are things here specifically that will get me sober, drunk, guess what? They will. You can take it to the bank. I can tell you how my drinking ended in a funny way. I stayed clean and sober for about a year, and I ended up back out on cocaine. Why? Because I didn't have a problem with cocaine. I had a problem with alcohol and speed. And so I thought, well, who cares? A little cocaine. And I'm telling this to you all because we have some misunderstandings here about what goes on here. I come from the school of we don't smoke dope on Sundays. You know, abstinence is abstinence, and I have a relationship with God that has to be the way it is. I'm going to talk about my friend and my teacher. I was raised on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you have been too because I've heard a lot about it here. I was raised with the forward to the first edition told me that I could be recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show you precisely, which is in italics, to show you precisely how we have recovered, that's the purpose of the book. Well, what's recovered? I remember when I was talking with my sponsor and he said, what do you think about being this recovered thing? I said, I don't think it exists. You know, I believe in recovery. We're always recovering, you know. And he said, man, that's too tiring. I don't want to always be recovering. He said, I said, well, are you recovered? He said, you know, as a matter of fact, I am. I said, well, how do you know that you are? He said, well, because I am. I said, well, am I recovered? He said, I don't know. And I said, well, how will I know when I am? And he said, when you are. Aren't they cute? Yeah. They get down to those three-word things that throw you off the chair. And I want to share this, too, that I got my sponsor when I had 5 years of sobriety. I had worked the steps, but something wasn't right in my program. Something didn't feel good. I knew I was a sprinter. I saw long-distance runners, and I couldn't get there. I have nothing against, and when I was in Narcotics Anonymous, all we had was the big book, so we weren't raised on other stuff. So I worked the book, the steps out of the big book. But I'm going to tell you what happened to me. Somebody said to me, you know what? Let's go hear the speaker tonight. And I said, because he knew I was kind of crazy. And I said, I don't know that I want to do that. He said, no, 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 you'll like him. So I went with some trepidation, and I really wasn't interested. And I'm sitting there like the fifth row, and here's this pudgy little guy up there with suspenders and kind of a goofy haircut. And he wasn't very funny. He's not a funny guy. But he started talking. And I listened, and it was just like Ebby and Bill. He shouted great tidings. I heard him talk about things I'd never heard anybody talk about. I heard him talk about that book in a way I didn't see that in that book. I never saw that. And it was like, have you ever sat in a room and like the person who's speaking sort of gets a glow around them or a circle and they're speaking right at you? And that's what happened. I went after that guy like a heat-seeking missile when that was over. I did. But I was sneaky about it. I'd call him and say, you know what, you don't know me, you know some of my friends, and I want to know if I can call you occasionally to ask you questions because I'm not real sure what I'm doing all the time. He said, absolutely. He always said yes. So I'd start calling him with things like, you know, somebody asked me this today, and I didn't know what to tell him. And he said, I said, what would you have said? He said, well, in my experience, XYZ. You know, he'd give me the thing, and I thought, man, this guy's good. And so I'd hang up the phone and go tell that person what he had told me. And it worked for a while. And then I did this like 2, 3, 4 times. And then one day I said, well, he said, I do with them what I do with every newcomer. And I said, well, what is that? He said, well, we sit down together once a week for an hour and we read the book together. And I said, really? And all of a sudden there's this pause, the hardest question in the whole world that had to come out of my mouth. And what was it? Will you do that with me? And he said, absolutely. And he did. He did tell me to have a female sponsor. I didn't tell him till the night before he died. I never did that. I said, did I ever mention to you I never did that? So you got to clean it up before they go. But that began a long and wonderful journey for me in the spirit. I did not have a sponsor who told me what to do, how to live my relationships, how many meetings to go to. I was never told that. I was never told 90 and 90. I was never told not to date. He prayed for me with some of the men I dated in sobriety. And there was one in particular I went out with for about 4 years, and he'd say things to me like, Janice, don't get hooked up with that one for too long. He's just passing through this time. You know, and it wasn't until after it was done that he told me, he said, I never worry about you. I worried about you. He said, I was afraid you were going to get over on that side of life and not be able to find your way back. It gets dark when we get too far away from spirit doing self-will. Gets very dark, and it's hard to find our way back. So anyway, he took me through the steps. And that's when I found out that I'm an alcoholic, hopeless alcoholic. It was the greatest relief in my sobriety. In the doctor's opinion, the phenomenon of craving never occurring in the average temperate drinker, I was like, oh my God. I am not a woman who came into Alcoholics Anonymous and felt like I belonged here. I hear all these people say, oh, I was home. You know, oh, I just felt like I came home. I didn't, but I did service work like a crazy person, and I knew I never wanted to drink again, so I was going to do what you did. And don't get scared, but I didn't feel home here till about 5 years ago. I just didn't get it. I didn't understand when people would talk about family, and this was the man who taught me how to do that. We sat together. We discussed all the various ways that my mind works to help me get another drink when I think I don't want to drink. Then, you know, without powerlessness, there is no second step. I do not need a power greater than myself to solve my problem. I just don't need it. I came in here with weird ideas about God, and I got to tell you something. You don't need no boop about God when you're talking about the second step. We sit there and philosophize and go through all this stuff about it and want to talk about what he looks like, what he does, what religion is he. All it says is I have to be willing that a power greater than myself can solve my problem. That's it. It is no big deal. I either am doing a good job or I'm not. And if I'm not doing a good job, maybe somebody else can help me with this. What in the chapter to agnostics, it talks about what is it? Are we going to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet? You know, what are we going to do? Are we going to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the misery and of our intolerable situation, right? You want to live a life based on spiritual principles, or do you want to go on like this till you die or go insane? Well, what do we say when we're asked that? I got to think about it. Right? I got to think about it. Do you want to take this shot, you know, and be cured, or do you want to go over here and languish and die? Well, I don't know. I'll tell you what. I went to the dentist once when I was doing all this speed, and my teeth were falling out of my head. Anybody who does speed knows that they're gone. And so I keep going to see the dentist because he was very handsome. And my teeth get worse and worse and worse. And he said to me, "I don't understand. Something's not right here with your teeth because they're not getting better." And I said, "Well, I do a few diet pills." And he looked at me and he said, "Janice, it's either your diet pills or your teeth. You need to decide." You know what I said? "I need to think about it." So I started taking calcium supplements. Yeah? I'm not powerless yet. The reason I like the chapter, we agnostics especially, and I'm just going to tell you this, is there's a line in the book that says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to have a power by which we could live, and exactly how are we going to find that power? It says that's exactly what this book is about, is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. The entire focus of our program isn't about getting smart about it. It isn't about getting therapized about it. It isn't about learning from other people how to do it. It's about me having an experience with the Creator through the willingness to quit thinking I can do stuff myself and to allow the space within my heart for the Creator to enter my heart that keeps me from taking the next drink. You see, we all think it's a drink that gets us in trouble, and it's not. By the time I put the drink in my mouth, I'm toast. It's over. It's the place before the drink is where it happens. In my mind is where it centers. It says we think the problem centers in the mind. Interesting. Okay, so I need something that's great. I'm glad that happened. I need something that stands between me and the thought of the next drink. Well, that's what the psychic change is. That's the psychic change. If I could make that happen, I would have done it. But I couldn't. That was the point. The whole basis of our program, like it or not, is a program based in spiritual principles. Steps don't keep us sober. Meetings don't keep us sober. Sponsors don't keep us sober. Potlucks do not keep us sober. Somebody, I think, disagreed. But anyway, all those things are the avenue to the Creator who stands between me and the thought of the next drink. Period, finish, final. That's it. You know, and what the steps are, the reason they don't keep me clean, they're the avenue through doing the things that I'm asked to do, which the number one principle experience there is having to comply, which I hate doing, which is to follow directions. And I begin by being willing enough to follow the directions that I've been given. And when I do that, and I turn my will and life over to a God I don't know and don't understand and have no idea what I'm doing, and then agree immediately to write my inventory, which says that I'm going to face and be rid of the things that are blocking me. From what? From God. From the God that's going to keep my head out of the way and stand between me and the next drink. Then I got to share that with somebody. I got to tell somebody who I am. I was fortunate enough to share this inventory with my sponsor. Do you know about the take it to the grave stuff? Well, if you don't, you need another sponsor. And I'm just kidding. Anyway, the take it to the grave stuff is the stuff we've never told anybody. And in the fifth step, it says, you know what? Some people get drunk because they want to hang on to the worst bits that we've done out of the shame of having to tell somebody else. Well, those worst bits live right here. The guilt, remorse, the dishonesty eventually will shut off the sunlight of the spirit, and we will drink again, and so that's why we disclose it to a closed mouth friend. So I'm doing my fifth step with this guy, and I told him everything. You see, he didn't have he had a yin and yang sort of heart. He wasn't, you know, anyway, some women can't do that. I did it because not of me, but because of who this person was. So I'm giving him all my inventory, a fifth step, and I said, "I guess it's time for the take it to the grave stuff." And he said, "Yes, it is." Oh, I'm sick to my stomach. I'm going to tell him something I've never told anybody. My hands are shaking. I got my arms on my knees, you know, looking down. I'm so full of shame. I couldn't even look up at him when I did it, you know, bouncing your legs. And I said, "Okay." And so I told him. Pause. I said, "Was that weird?" He said, "Yeah, that was really weird." I thought, oh, I knew it. I'm so horrible. And he said, but I need to tell you something I did once. And he put it out there, and I looked at him. I said, man, that is really weird. And I knew that was not even in his consciousness ever again. It was gone. It was gone. But guess what? I was free. I didn't have that thing right here that I was going to carry with me in shame. My 6 and 7 have changed through the years. I just want you to know that I'm changing now. And I'm in the middle of amends. And it's been a whole new journey for me. It's a whole different set. You know how people say, oh, I just work the steps once and stay in 10, 11, and 12? Have fun. Oh, I don't know. You know, I try not to be critical anymore. I mean, if that works for you, that's great. It didn't work for me. Because it says in a business that doesn't take a regular inventory usually goes broke. Operative word, regular. And for me, more things have been revealed here. You know, all the stuff that I've had an opportunity to turn over to the Creator, if all that appeared in the first 1 to 5 years, I would have committed suicide. It was too hard. I have a dark past. I've had a lot of things that happened to me, and I have a lot of pain. I hang out with a lot of men, you know, they like me, and the tougher they are, the better. Do you want to know why? Because God has given me the opportunity to see the tenderness in their hearts and the pain that they're suffering without recrimination or wanting something from it. If you have not enjoyed the relationships and friendships of opposite sex, don't miss it. Don't miss it. We can be friends. We don't all have to sleep together. We like to do that earlier in recovery, but after a while, you know, it's cool. I believe that we have healing hearts here. I also believe that we're called to heal. It's no mistake that we're here. But we aren't called to heal for us so that we feel better and go home and bake cookies. We are called to heal for each other. It's through my experience and sharing that with others, that's the whole purpose of what I've been through. I want to talk about some of the stuff that's gone on in my sobriety. I have some friends here that know what that's about. One of the reasons I love it when Bob speaks, you know what the key is for me? Is that he talks present day. He talks about what he went through. And I had an opportunity to tell Bob yesterday that a talk he gave many years ago when my life was in severe turmoil and I heard him talk, he gave me hope. Because he had been through what I was going through. It didn't save me, it didn't save my life, but for just a glimmer, I knew that I wasn't alone. And that if this guy could stay sober, that maybe I would get through it. And I got to tell him that. I was so happy to share that with him because I am coming through what happened. I want you to know in sobriety, I've been in an abusive relationship. And it was pretty ugly. It lasted for about 5 years. What that did for me too was, it wasn't just that he was abusive, I was violent. I didn't become violent until I had about 7 years of sobriety. I say this to women out there because, you see, we aren't taught how to be angry. Guys beat each other up on the football field, the hoo-hoo, you know, hoo-hoo stuff they do. And we don't do that. We got to act like ladies. I'm going to tell you what. It was not a pretty sight. And I know there's someone out there right now throwing temper tantrums just like I did, thinking they're crazy. You're not crazy. That we spent years shoving away all the pain, all the grief, all the unshed tears, all that. All of us, not just women, but men too. And when that stuff came full blast, oh my God, I would pick up anything in the way and throw it. And I owned my own house, which was really convenient. And I mean it. I have a brass cigarette lighter holder. And I mean, that thing's got to weigh a pound and a half. And it'll put a hole in a wall quicker than you can spit. And so anyway, I'm in this abusive relationship, and what happened was I couldn't leave it. I couldn't leave it. Oh, I didn't mention that he had a common-law wife when we started. See, one of my things when I was sober was I liked married men. I liked them a lot because they weren't there at Christmas. They didn't bug you too much when you were hungover. You got the trips to Mexico, you know, but they didn't whine a lot, and you could kind of get drunk, and they're home with the kids, and worked out really well. And oh my, I loved them. And but when I got into recovery, I thought I was done with that. See, I thought I got here and got well because I wasn't drinking. And I said, I'm not going to behave like that anymore. Isn't it great? And I did. Anyway, somebody said to me, well, Janice, he's married. I said, no, he's not. That's common law. There's difference. And but it was a violent relationship. And it was pretty scary. I didn't really get hurt physically too bad till right near the end. And it's almost a shame. It's hard to even talk about. But I don't even remember doing that when I was drunk. Well, you see, I had nothing to hide from anymore. And I used to try and leave him, I used to take my sponsor, my inventory about it. I'd write, you know, and take it to him, and he'd listen. I'd write, you know, some more and take it back, and he'd listen. And then one day he said to me, "Aren't you sick about writing about this?" And he said, "Because I'm really sick of listening to it." And of course, my thought is, that's your damn job. Your job is listen to my inventory. Well, see, that's not their job. He didn't say that to me. He was more polite. But anyway, and I can't leave. You know how you get those relationships in, out, they move out, manny, nanny, you know, they're dating somebody else, you're dating, but you can't stay away from each other. And one day I'm saying, dear God, I knew I was dying inside, and I knew this was trouble. I said, why can't I end this? I can see how damaging it is, how sick it's making me. Why can't I do this? And I can remember this, just like the first drink kind of thing. Spiritual experiences are like that. I can see where I was driving. I was headed up north on University Boulevard. God, why can't I stop this? And the voice said, because you're beyond human aid. And that's when I got it. This is a solution that will solve all my problems. See, because after the drink problem is gone, there's going to be life. And it is not pretty sometimes. But when we're in the middle of it and we're not being honest with each other in meetings about what's going on in our lives, I'm not saying a dumping ground, but letting people know we have stuff going on, then what happens is the person in the corner who's got the stuff going on thinks they're doing something wrong. See, for years I thought I was doing something wrong because everybody was happy, joyous, and free and acting like nothing was going on, you know, and they were all cleaned up and, you know, they were sober, and next thing I knew they were attorneys with Cadillacs, right? I'm like, how did you do that? I can't get out of my house. I'm in the fetal position with a knife at 7 or 8 years of sobriety. I'll show you what a healthy little piece of work I was. That guy was supposed to come to my house after he'd been out. He didn't come. 3 or 4 in the morning, I'm hysterical. And I thought, he's sleeping with somebody else. And I was furious. So I drive to his house, like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I pull up, he drove a little Alfa Romeo. And I put my hand on the car and it was warm. I thought, I nailed him. He just got home, I've nailed him. And I became convinced that there was somebody in the house with him. Knock, 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 wouldn't answer. Knock, 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 wouldn't answer. And I could see him in there, and I thought, who is it that he's with? 7 years of sobriety, I climbed in his kitchen window. I did. And somebody said, why'd you do that? I said, I wanted to know who he was sleeping with. And I thought we should have a cup of coffee and a glass of orange juice and talk about it. So if you're doing weird stuff out there, oh, by the way, when with anybody, but that's a good thing. But so if you're doing weird stuff out there, it's part of the healing process. That's who I am. That's who I am without alcohol. That's who I am without a God. That's the best I can do. And I can't change that behavior on my own. Another little story. Is it about 15 years of sobriety, my little life started falling apart. And I'd been very successful in business. Made really good money, bought my own house. Nobody gave me a house. I've only been married twice. Each one was about a year. And I don't do it well. I get agitated. agitated. It's the weirdest thing. You know, you date them, you don't know a lot about them, you get married to them, you find out about them, and you're like, I'm agitated. Or you wake up one morning, you look at him and say, did your teeth always look like that? Things like, what do you mean you've never read a book? Is that great? The last one I married is my very dear friend. Don't miss that, people. I mean my friend. And we both agreed to make amends to each other. The reason I got married was because I was a very sick woman later on in sobriety. I had some problems I didn't know I had. My life had fallen apart. We'll talk about that, and I needed rest. I had supported myself since I was 18 years old pretty successfully. Bought my own house, did my own thing, took care of other people, gave money away until I remembered it, and until I was broke and said, didn't I give you money? And... But I married him because I needed help. I'm not one of those women where men come up and go, boy, you know, I just want to take care of you. Not do everything, just, you know, pay half the mortgage. And I always made more money than the men I dated, and they liked that a lot. But anyway, so I needed to rest, and that's why I got married. And he needed to rest, and that's why he got married. Those are not good reasons for getting married. And I didn't have a clear ideal. I really didn't, and I was so crazy trying to fix my life because it was so nuts. I thought if I could just rest for 6 months, I could figure it out. And ended up having to get some extra help. I tell him, you're the best thing that ever happened to me, because I then found out how truly sick I was. And I had about 15 years of sobriety, 16. And I having this thing, and I'm thinking I'm having a heart attack. And so I go, oh, my heart attack. I mean, I would just be dying. Couldn't breathe, went in the hospital a couple times. And, you know, they're like, no, that's not it. Had to take a thallium stress test. And at the time, I didn't know I was pregnant. I have no children, and I wanted a baby more than anything else in the whole world. I'd had miscarriages and such here in recovery. 45 years old, and I thought, this is it. This is it. This is the reward for all the work I've done here for God. And so I'm going to have a baby. I didn't care if I was married or not. I was rolling in the dough. I'll hire a nanny. I was out looking at furniture. I'm like, yes, I have earned this. I have finally been blessed enough. So anyway, in the meantime, I get like this breast lump, and they're thinking it's cancerous, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, I mean, it was just a weird time. And I had a miscarriage. And I'm going to tell you what, I was one of the angriest women you ever want to be around. It was bad. I heard myself saying, and the Al-Anons will appreciate this, I heard myself saying, God, after everything I've done for you. And I meant it. I had sponsored people. I ran them in and out of the house behind each other. I've been out giving talks. I've been doing this. I've been moving people in who needed a place to rest. I did everything. I did it all, and this is what I get. I just didn't get it, and I was a bitter, angry woman. And I remember my sponsor called me and said, people are concerned about you, and they want to know what to do. What do you want me to tell them to do? I said, leave me the hell alone. Tell them not to call. I'm done. And I wasn't going to sponsor again. Nothing. And people would call me that used to whine on the phone. I had a woman call me who'd been seeing a married man for like 20 years. And in the past, I would listen and kind of give her direction, whatever. She called during this time for me and started to complain about it. And I said, you know, I need to ask you something. Were you clear this man was married when you started seeing him? She said, yeah. How long have you been doing it? 18 to 20 years. I said, well, you know what? What you're getting is what you get when you do this. Now, either do it and get that or get out. And that's what I said to people. I didn't spend a lot of time with them anymore. And what that meant was I didn't have room. I didn't have room. Every day was a survival day. Over a period of time, I lost my house and all my investments. Everything was gone. I got sick. Everything, it was like sitting there on a park bench and seeing a snowball, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And before I knew it, everything was gone. I almost committed suicide. And the reason was I didn't know what I was going to do without my investments and without my equity in my house, because you see, my parents had died. My mom died when I was 18, my dad when I was 21. I was technically an orphan at 18. My dad asked me to leave. I've been taking care of myself a long time, so I thought that if I had all that in place, I'd be okay. I'd be okay in my old age. And also, one of the things I depended on the most was my mind, my ability to make decisions, my ability to earn a living, my ability to do whatever. My mind was a great and glorious thing. And at the same time that happened, it broke. And who I knew myself to be was no longer. She was gone. I couldn't pull rabbits out of the hat. I couldn't do it. I was in business for myself at that point. I was making really good money. I couldn't do it. I couldn't fly across the country anymore. I couldn't do anything. And there I stood. And so I'm looking around going, well, if I can't do that, I'm going to die. And I was so mad at God, I could have spit nails. So I decided to go through, I didn't decide to go through the steps again. It so happened that I did go through the steps again, because you see, if it's God that separates us from the thought of the next drink, what my God was saying to me at that time were things like, you didn't expect it to be any better than this, did you? Those were the voices I was hearing. Things like, that's what you get for being the kind of person you are. That was what I heard. And I thought, we have a problem. Got to do it. And so what I realized was that if that's what's keeping me sober, I need some help. I'm so grounded in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God, that I know that the only way to have a new relationship with the Creator, the fifth step says, to have a new attitude and a new relationship with the Creator, and I needed one, because not to fix my money, not to give me a new baby, because I knew I was going to drink if I didn't get a God that could protect me from that, and the one I had wasn't it. So I ended up going through the steps. At the second step, I had a terrible, terrible problem with it. I couldn't do it. God's either everything or he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. I'm not going for that. And so I went to my sponsor, and he asked me to do something. He said, I want you to make a list of the attributes of your God. So I did. I brought it back to him. We were having lunch at Dario's, lots of garlic. And he said, I want you to read me the list. And I did. And he said, Janice, I had two nice things on there. And it was about you guys. And he heard it, and he said to me, you know what? This isn't God. He said, who is this? This is a person. Who is it? Who was it? It's my father. It's my dad. Well, that just wasn't going to work anymore. And so I didn't know I had that God. I kept saying, God did this, God did that, God is great, God is good. Well, that's because I was successful. You see, you're going to find out who you are when all that stuff was protecting me and keeping me separate from each and every one of you. That's where my faith was. I didn't even know my faith was there until it started going away. I do not think God did that to me. I think my desire to know and have a relationship with God is why it happened, because it says that we must turn in all things to the Father of light. And some things I get confronted with that I don't even know are blocking me. But because God loves us so much and the Spirit wants to heal, we're called to heal. So anyway, I go through that, I go through the steps, and I want you to know I'd written inventory on my dad a lot of times, but this time I wrote it with the understanding that he was separating me from God, that relationship was. Well, I want to tell you, in a short note, I got free. Not because I wanted to be free, I wanted a new relationship with God, and God read my heart, and that's what happened. If you want, come up and see me. I had a great amend, and I got set free. Prior to that, I had no good memories of my youth. I'm a woman who came in here with no memories from birth to 15 years old, and I had no good memories. After that happened, it was about a year and a half later, that knot in your gut, that resentment, that recent tear about my father was gone. I didn't love him, but it was gone. About a year and a half later, the most remarkable thing happened. I began to have wonderful memories of my time with my father, things I had been unable to see before. I got to see that he used to take me to baseball games on hot summer nights in El Paso. And we'd sit out there and eat popcorn and hot dogs and drink Coca-Colas. He was a young doctor, and I got to see that he took me on his house calls when he was a young doctor. But that couldn't have come back without the act of God. Do I have a lot of stuff now? No. That ability or that desire, or I don't have the kind of desire to own things anymore, and I really don't think I'm just telling myself that's because I don't have a lot. Something's happened. It's really weird. And that's the change I'm talking about. It's like, it was just so much work, you know, and you have to dust everything. you know, and I watched the economy. Remember, we had that terrible thing with the stock market, and I sat back and said, well, my friends can come talk to me because, you see, I'm cool. I have nothing to lose anymore. You know, and I saw them freaking out, and I'm like, it'll be okay. And also, when it happened, people would come up to me and say things like, oh, it's just money. I thought, yeah, my money, not yours. We're done, almost. Did you say good? Well, you could have just gone to the bathroom. I don't know if he really said that or not. I hope in your journey that you will be as fortunate as some of us have been to have great teachers. A great teacher isn't a teacher, he's a show and tell kind of guy. And he shows and tells through his experience. We recently have lost a lot of great teachers in Denver over the last year. And what I found out was they didn't only teach us how to live, they taught us how to die. My sponsor died with great dignity. His house was filled with people every day, right up until the end. All of his grandchildren, all of us, we were eating, laughing. He taught us how to die, as did some of my other friends. I'm ever so grateful for that experience and to be shown the way, but I'm going to say something else that just came to me. Terry, hold on. We talk about this being a suggested program. You hear how people say, oh, you can't ask me to do that. These are suggestions. Haven't you heard that? These are just suggestions, right? Off the hook, suggestions. Well, I have come up with an understanding of what that means. You see, the book says it's a suggested program of recovery, which means there are four other suggested programs at least. People actually get well through psychiatry. They get well swimming, I guess. They get well in church. You know, people get well other ways. We do not have a corner on the market. However, if we agree to do this program, if we're not doing exactly what it says in that book, we ain't doing this program. If people say to me it didn't work, what I say is, or ask, well, what were you doing? What were you doing that it didn't work? See, it works. It's us who don't bring our stuff to it. But if you're not doing what it says in there, I don't do checkoff sheets. There are no checkoff sheets in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. People bring me these checkoff sheets for their inventory. I'm like, I don't get it. I'd love to, like, check it off. Sure. Yeah, I think I did that. I don't think so. And also, if I don't know who I am, I'm not going to have an experience here. It sounds really basic, but it is. But I only know one way to do it. I am not a book-thumping kind of girl anymore, but I do know if I'm not doing this, I'm not doing Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I'm doing something else, it isn't working. And I need to find my other way. I have a great relationship with the power in my life today as a result of doing the work with God. I'm not rich. I'm not famous. I don't really even have a lot anymore, you know? But you know what I have? I have a peace. I'm at peace. It's the most wonderful thing in the whole world. I was never at peace. Do I have 2 minutes to tell them about this? I never like talk over an hour. Terry knows it's just so rude and self-indulgent. For some reason, I'm being moved to tell you this. 19 or 20 years, I found out there was something really wrong with me. My head doesn't work right. My friends knew that. I thought I was eccentric. But it was during this marriage I found out I was a very, very sick woman, and I had been throughout my sobriety, and that's why when my mind left me, part of it was I could no longer go on the way I was. I had to seek outside help, and my sponsor didn't believe in that. And I said, I have to get help. I can't do this, you know, because he used to say things to me, I think we missed something. Later I had to say, no kidding, we missed something. I was crazy. But anyway, I had to get outside help, and I want to talk about this because outside help is not the solution. Got to hear that. Pills are not the solution. I have two things. I got a mind that has bad electricity, and I have alcoholism, and I treat them in two different places. All right? And I am so grateful that I was given the spiritual solution and that I was as sick as I was for as many years as I was. I'm not crying because I was sick. I'm crying... My friends cried because I was sick. But I am crying because I was given such a great foundation, and I believed if I would just do more, I would feel better. I didn't know what was wrong. And so when I got diagnosed, it was a real struggle for me because I came from the Alcoholics Anonymous that you don't do anything. Man, you maybe take aspirin and Advil, but that's about it. And here I was humbled because I was a very sick girl that could have ended up easily in the hospital. And... it was on my way, but as a matter of fact, they've told me if I ever want to come back, they'll have a bed for me. And the reason I want to talk about it is because I hear stuff about it, and they are two separate items. Medication did not make me well. God made me well, and then I found out how sick I was, and that just helped me be well. I see a doctor for that I have to go to on a regular basis to monitor me. And I work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have to live sort of this weird life in double diligence. Any of us that suffer out there, double diligence, because I want to play the game that the reason I'm being a witch today is because my electricity isn't working. And what the truth is, I'm probably being a witch. And so I say this, there's a lot of that stuff going on in our program today, and I'm hearing that that the medication is a solution, and it is not. And when people come and whine to me about it, I got to tell you something. I look at them and I say, you're coming to the wrong girl. I suffered for 19 years and didn't know. But God was bigger than everything, bigger than the disease, bigger than the craziness. I did service work, and I'm not saying you got to do it the way I did it. God was bigger than all of it. Because in my heart, I wanted to be sober more than anything else in the world, and God reads our hearts. We'll look at people who are sponsored in a weird way. By the way, if you have a weird sponsor, you picked them. And God reads our hearts. God knows our higher self, our spiritual self knows where we're headed by what's written on our hearts, and it will be honored. If you ask the universe, it will respond. Have we had any fun? Did I get too serious? I love you. Thank you for having me here. Thank you for the ocean. Thank you for the gifts. Thank you for each and every one of you. And to my fellow travelers, and you know who you are. God bless you.